Yeah, great. Thanks. Everybody, come on in. We're going to make this session pretty interactive because we've got a nice small room here. So as we're going through, don't be shy. If you've got questions or if you want to take the conversation in a different direction, just jump right in. I've already posted all the slides you're going to see out onto SpeakerDeck. So there'll be some links in here that you might care about, some links to some repos and some other things. So if you don't want to have to scribble anything down or take pictures of the screen, the slides have already been uploaded to make that a little bit easier on you. Really happy to be here today with Ben Lewis, and we'll actually spend hopefully most of the time actually looking at some of the work that he's been doing and his team has been doing at the Center for Geographic Analysis at Harvard around the National Water Model. So he'll come up and talk in just a second, but I'm going to sort of start the presentation by talking a little bit about what MAPD is, what the technology is, what the open source piece of it is. Here's our contact information. Please feel free to contact me through any of those channels. I'm happy to stay in contact with folks, and I'll stick around at the end of the presentation if anybody wants to chat or has further questions. So let's get started. What is MAPD? MAPD is an open source SQL database built from the ground up to run on GPUs instead of CPUs. So I imagine folks here understand the difference between GPUs and CPUs, but just to make it painfully clear, it's really two things that make the difference. One is the number of cores in the GPU. So you're talking about orders of magnitude more cores, which means much greater parallel processing in the GPU compared to the CPU. And the second thing is the speed of the memory. The memory in the GPU is actually built into the chip, so it makes it much, much faster. Now, that also limits the memory, so you do not have unlimited memory like you basically do with CPUs. So we have to be really judicious about how we use that memory, and I'll talk a little bit more about how we do that in MAPD a little bit later. So those two characteristics of GPUs, though, make them particularly good at things like graphics. So you see them in your Xbox, and also good at things like AI and machine learning, which I'm sure you know you've heard about at least, and the explosion that's happening there. But it turns out it's also really good for doing SQL queries. We can take each individual SQL query, break it down, run it efficiently in a parallel manner across those multiple cores. And so MAPD was created about 7 years ago. The first iterations of it started at MIT in the CSAIL lab. Took about 2 years to get to a point where it was ready to become a company. Formed the company about 5 years ago, and we've been growing the technology ever since. So this just helps me illustrate sort of the difference between CPUs and GPUs. As I said, I suspect that most folks in this audience already understand that difference. But I often get the question, so if GPUs are so much faster, why don't we use them for everything? Well, there's always that set of tasks that run better in serial instead of parallel because they cannot be parallelized. So there are things that will run faster on a CPU than a GPU just because they can't take advantage of that parallelization. And each individual instruction on a CPU is faster than each individual instruction on a GPU. So if you have something that's parallel, great, run it on a GPU. If you have something that's serial, fantastic, a problem that's serial, fantastic, run it on your CPU. And this is why most modern systems actually have both. And MAPD actually takes advantage of both because we can recognize when things will run most efficiently on each of those different kinds of hardware. So this is the sort of basic architecture of where MAPD lives in your system. We are not typically a store of record. So typically you'll have your data living somewhere else in an existing database. Or you'll have streaming data that's coming in live, and we'll talk a little bit about that when we get to the Kafka example. You'll use one of these interfaces then for actually ingesting that data into MAPD, into GPU memory. Then it lives within this stack. At the bottom we have our database, or we call it the SQL engine. This is the thing that's built to run on top of the GPUs and take advantage of those GPUs. Then we have a rendering engine and a visualization system on top of that. When I show the demo in just a second, I'm actually going to show this entire stack. And so we'll talk about those different pieces more explicitly. The core, the database, is the part that's open source. So you can go to GitHub today and you know play with the database itself to your heart's content. We're starting to build our community now around that open source engine. It's Apache licensed. On the other side, then, you can also use these additional interfaces for building custom applications, using your existing favorite BI GIS tools, or doing additional machine learning, running additional machine learning, doing machine learning in addition to your data analysis. All of that interfaces directly with the GPU using standard open interfaces. So let's jump to a demo because I think it'll help me tell the story. Oops. All right. So this is 12 billion rows of data. This is U.S. Coast Guard data over about a six-year period. Those 12 billion rows are actual individual pings coming from ships in U.S. waters. They have to send a ping to the U.S. Coast Guard about every half hour that tells what kind of boat it is, what direction it's headed, what it has on board, what size it is, all that information. So we've taken... Yeah, sure. That's right. That's exactly right. So 12 billion rows of data, we ingested that into MapD. So now it's in our database. And then we used the Immerse, which was the top thing on that stack that I showed, to build this set of dashboard, or this set of charts on a dashboard. So we have the ship type, we have the length, we have the time, and then we have a map that shows the locations, the individual locations. If I click on, If I click on just one of the passenger type, or one of the ship types, and I say, okay, just show me the passenger ships, you saw that all of the charts changed. That's cross-filtering. That's pretty simple. But what actually happened was each of these charts sent a SQL query back to the database and did a brute force query across all 12 billion rows and returned the results in about 300 milliseconds, sometimes faster. So what we're doing is no pre-indexing, no aggregation, no special effects in terms of what actually happens inside the database. Instead, we're just relying on the speed and the brute force nature of the GPUs to give us this kind of performance. And I can show you by doing a quick circle here. Boom, again, all the things changed. I've now gone down to 149 million records just by taking a small snapshot of the northeast or the northwest. And this chart is actually the most interesting one because not only is it sort of taking the 149 million rows, but it's actually passing that result back into the GPU and letting the GPU do the rendering of the image. So all that comes back to the client is a PNG. And then we put that PNG on top of a Mapbox map to be able to showcase the data for that 149 million rows. And we haven't lost any of the fidelity of that data. So... let me just get rid of this, and then I can hover over any one of these individual points. And you can see I still have the full data of this was the boat, it was a passenger ship, this was the time that it was at that specific location, its length, etc. Of course, there's not 632 million pixels in this image. So what we actually pass back is not just the PNG, but also a metadata file that includes all of the records that are associated with that one point. So in this case, when I do the flyover, I'm just showing sort of the first, but I can actually see all of them if I need to. And so it's this capability of having an interactive map, having that interactive capability that most of our users get pretty excited about. And this actually takes advantage of all three layers of that stack that I showed. So it's the really fast database on the bottom. It's the rendering engine to take the results of the query and create the PNG. And it's the Immerse front end then for building this chart itself that you can actually see in the dashboard. All right, so the three things that our customers and our users are really excited about. One, speed. So that interactive nature means that it unlocks a certain curiosity with analysts. Second is scale. I don't know any other platform that can go to tens of billions or hundreds of billions of rows of data and still provide that level of interactivity. And then third is that sort of that cross-filter interaction, that experience you get with MapD of being able to actually play with the data. And just to show one more thing real quick. I'm going to put this down for a second. So I turned on SQL logging. All this will do is show me the actual SQL queries that are going back and forth from the client to the server. So now if I come back in here and I get rid of the passenger, again, five queries basically are going back to the server. You can see not only the actual SQL query itself, but the time, so 138 seconds, 127 milliseconds, 145 milliseconds, so pretty fast query times. This is running off of a server in California. It's actually four nodes. Each node has four GPUs in it, so it's a pretty big server to be able to hold all that data. But that's only because this is a live demo. You can go today to mapd.com/demos and play with this yourself, and we want to be able to make sure that we can have multiple people playing with this at once. So if we wanted to do this sort of and just have it for a single user, wouldn't necessarily need to be quite that big. But as you can see, it runs very efficiently on four nodes with 16 GPUs for 12 billion rows of data. Our largest customers have hundreds of billions of rows, so tens of billions is not even really stressing the system. Any questions on the demo? Just point data for now? I mean, in this data set? Yeah, so the Coast Guard actually has a way for us to kind of tie the different pieces together and create more of trajectory data. We just haven't done it yet. So, yeah, it would be. All right. I'm going to jump back to the slides because I want to talk for a second about... So I'm doing on time. Great. I want to talk for a second about... I talked a little bit about the hardware piece of what makes this so fast. I also want to talk about the software piece of what makes this so fast because it's really the combination of the two that gives you the performance that you're seeing. So one of the most important pieces is the memory management. I talked at the beginning about how having that memory built into the chip was a blessing and a curse. The blessing is it's super, super fast, but the curse is you cannot expand it unless you add more chips. The only way to do it is to add more GPUs. So you have to be really, really careful about how you use that memory. And so what happens in MapD, when you load your data, typically you're going to put it on an SSD first. When the database is actually running, we'll put the data itself, the table itself, into CPU memory, all of it. Then when you run your first query, we'll pull the columns that you're querying against up into GPU memory. But we're only going to pull the columns you're querying against. We don't pull all of the data. So you don't need GPU memory to cover your entire table. You just need it to cover the parts that you're going to be querying against. And then we're smart about managing that so that if you run your next query and it needs other tables or other columns, of course, we'll drop columns and bring new columns in. So you pay a little bit of a price to go from CPU memory to GPU memory. It's hundreds of milliseconds. But once you have it in GPU memory, then it's unbelievably fast. And this is actually the typical use case. The typical use case is you run and query maybe 20 or 50 times, sort of fine-tuning it to find the answers that you're looking for. Similar to the ship's demo, basically, I was running the same queries over and over again. I was just slowly refining it down to an area and down to a certain chip type and down to a certain, you know, maybe time of day to get the answers I was looking for. So once you have those columns in, then the queries become very, very fast. But this memory management is super important, and it's one of the things that makes the open source database so fast. So you can buy different chips that have different size memory capabilities. So the gamer chips will have less, and the new enterprise chips will have tens of gigs. So they're getting bigger and bigger. No, not per core, per chip. So they're getting bigger and bigger, and we continue to push NVIDIA to make chips that have more and more memory in them for the enterprise space. And as enterprise becomes a bigger piece of their revenue, they're certainly open to doing it. So. I'm not going to go to that level, we can talk about it afterwards. I don't go to that level in this presentation. So one more quick thing that makes our database fast is using LLVM to do query compilation. So queries, of course, themselves are interpreted, but we can use LLVM to compile them down to make them super fast, basically put them into CUDA code to run fast on a GPU. And so We've been doing this from the beginning, and it makes a huge difference in terms of the performance. It also makes it possible for us to optimize for other hardware scenarios. So, for instance, you can run MapD on just CPUs if you want to. It's also very, very fast. I run it in a Docker container on my laptop almost every day for playing around with. You're going to miss out on a few things. You're going to miss out on some of the speed, of course, because you don't get the massive parallelization. You're also going to miss out on the rendering, so you have no GPU there to do any rendering, so you don't get that capability. The API does not work. But if all you're looking to do is fast SQL queries, running it on a CPU is a perfectly reasonable solution, especially at, you know, testing. And then when you actually put it into production, of course, you'll run it on a GPU with your full data set. But this query compilation is another one of those things, you know, little things that we've done inside the software to make it fast and to really focus on speed as the primary objective. Of course, we're using Apache Arrow as one of our interfaces to the data, and we're using it more and more. This is straight out of the Apache Arrow website, so I imagine you guys have already seen this. I actually spend a fair amount of time when I go out to pitch MapD and to talk with technical audiences explaining what Arrow is and how valuable it is to them as developers. We use this both with our GDF, the GPU data frame, and with Pandas as well. Being able to have that Arrow single memory interface proves to be very, very valuable. We like it especially for those machine learning pipelines where you want to be able to do a little bit of work inside MapD, inside Immerse to figure out what your feature engineering, to do your feature engineering, figure out what features matter. Then you want to go and actually do your training, but you don't want to have to take that data out of GPU and kind of pass it around between these different tools. You just want to be able to pass the Arrow pointer and say, here's the Arrow data that you need. Go and run the training against this particular data set. So we've been working with Anaconda and H2O and other and NVIDIA to be able to make that possible, make those kinds of data science pipelines possible. So here's the sort of example of that from our, or this is how we explain it to folks from our perspective. You have your data in MapD Core. You have the ability to get your GPU data frame using Apache Arrow. And then that makes it possible for doing these other things without having to pass the data out in and out of CPU memory, which is how we were doing it before. It wasn't a bad way to do it, just wasn't efficient. Now we're, you know, orders of magnitude faster in terms of the entire pipeline. Couple examples. You can go to PyMapD and actually see how to run this in Python. You can go to the PyGDF to see how we do it with the GPU data frame as well. There's a few examples out there of notebooks that you can actually run to show you how to take advantage of it if you're interested. One more quick example. So I talked a little bit about the GPU Open Analytics a second ago, but we actually created a demo with Volkswagen for NVIDIA's conference last year. We have the repo out there that you can go and see what we did with them, and we also have a video of it running. Unfortunately, the only thing that's missing there is the data. We can't share Volkswagen's data with you, even as much as we tried to mask it. But at least it'll give you a sense from a code perspective of how we connect into the database, load the data into the database, do the feature engineering, do the machine learning, see the predictive results, and do the black box modeling afterwards. All right, so that was a lot to go through, but I wanted to use this as kind of the background of what MapD is and how it's using at least Arrow today internally. I'm going to hand it over to Ben, who's going to talk a little bit about the work they've done with the National Water Model, and then we'll come back and talk about how we've integrated Kafka into that setup. Cool?
Sounds good.
Oh, you don't need that.
Is that let me?
The big button?
Yeah. Hi there. This is a fun project for us. MapD actually incubated in our center back in 2013, 2014, when Todd Mostak came to us with the need to visualize billions of tweets. He was actually a Middle Eastern Studies major at the time, who was also happened to be a world-class computer hacker and computer scientist. And so the rest is history. They've become a successful startup, and open sourced their core technology and then came back and wanted to work with us under an NSF consortium group that we're part of. So basically, we've been looking at MapD, exploring it for a particular use case, that is, using it with output from large models, in this case, the National Water Model. And also, kind of as part of that, thinking about MapD's open source GPU database in the context of the world of Phos4G tools and thinking about how to make recommendations to improve interoperability. So increasing spatial resolution on these data sets is changing things. The National Hydro data set, a medium resolution model, has 300 million reaches. 3 million reaches. The high res has 30 million reaches. Time is also changing things for geospatial data. Multiple observations and predictions for even a few feature properties can quickly add up to billions of records. Needless to say, traditional GIS software has a hard time supporting queries or rendering, let alone analytics, against record numbers of more than several million, typically. Model observations data uses a computational procedure, typically, to convert a measurement of a stimulus into an estimation of an observed property for a feature of interest. And the National Water Model follows this approach. So simulation and prediction models extend this paradigm to generate properties of places and or times that differ from those at which the measurement was made, and the National Water Model does so. So outputs of such models have at least three different time senses. There's valid time, that's the time within which the model inputs apply, and the output's valid. There's phenomenon time, that's the observed, simulated, predicted property estimate. And the result time, that's the time that the model output is available for use, which may, in some cases, be available after the valid time when the computation is lengthy. So for studying big models, one needs compute power, which can scale to the volume of the model output to be processed, juxtaposed, or compared. Traditional parallel computing, Spark, for example, can address volume, but generally doesn't provide throughput to support interactive interpretation, sometimes is not very cost effective to scale, especially for use to support many analysts on a given data set. GPU can provide an alternative using its parallelism in place, fast execution for certain operations, and components such as a GPU database can be assembled into tool chains. So, the National Water Model takes hydro processes and weather processes to make predictions about precipitation on the surface of the Earth, flow into rivers, recharge, evaporation, and the amount of water that occurs in some 3 million stream reaches. The model runs on a Cray supercomputer, which is generating each hour predictions up to 30 days in advance for 2 million stream reaches, 12,000 reservoirs, And about 300 million surface grid points. So it's generating about 90 gigs of data a day. There are some viewers available for pre-generated images of the present model output. But it's difficult to visualize this kind of model output because of its size. The hydro model, the weather research and forecasting hydrological modeling system, or WRF hydro model, basically this is indicating there's several stages to the model. In part one, weather models produce forcing data. Two, the landscape model looks at rain or other precipitation on the surface of the Earth. Various models look at what is snow, what is water, what is infiltration, different hydrological processes, and then use the terrain model to route that moisture into streams, lakes, reservoirs, and produces forecasts for each of those different data types. So lots of moving pieces and physics that may work at one scale but not at another scale. So there's a lot of opportunity here to look at this data and ask, you know, the stuff coming out as forecasts, is it reasonable? Is it representing what is happening according to other observations? And to do so in a timely way if we're talking about potential flooding or potential water-related disasters. So data flow, this really goes into some detail on what we had to do to change paradigms moving from standard GIS data into a big data system. From the NWM model, there's a set of data files represent different parts of the phenomenon in valid time for the different parameters. And for those different representations, the different streams, grids, and so on, and these are all made available on an FTP site, which has a whole bunch of files on it. So how do we get that stuff into the database? We initially grabbed a bunch of them and then decided which time periods we wanted to set. We decided on every 6 hours, as that lets us line up valid and phenomenon time equally up to 10 days in advance of a particular set of model runs. Then, as we went through a variety of tools, particularly Pandas data frames, which was very useful for dealing with NetCDF and getting the proper parameters out, and there's the PyMapD API, that allows us to use Python scripting and Apache Arrow to throw the results very quickly straight into a MapD data frame. So how does this work? Generally, GPU memory is very fast, but it's a resource to conserve. MapD runs a number of different levels with a hierarchical storage scheme, as Aaron described. A lot of the organization is about deciding what to keep at the different levels. So we have loading of the file of the data frame into a column. It's a column-oriented store, which is useful for having some flexibility in the data model. If you need a new parameter, just add a new column. Only the columns that are needed for a query are loaded into CPU and then into GPU memory, so you can return the data, or you can use inter-process communication of that in place net result memory to render images, heat maps, for example. So it's possible from a very large data store to use very little bandwidth and still get results. For example, get an image of a heat map with, you know, 100 million features displayed, as you saw in Aaron's presentation. So that's one part of a more general capability to keep the computations in the GPU memory. Another aspect of that is that MapD supports really fast compilers, as Aaron described. We can compile the queries into single functions as fast as we can try to run them. So that's one part of the more general capability. One aspect of being able to run queries on both CPU and GPU is that depending on what aspects are particularly useful on the GPU, you can use the generally larger CPU memory. So initial work with NWM and MapD, we loaded a 10-day store and ran it on a fairly limited GPU instance. Some of you doing GPU-powered computations may know that access to GPU hardware depends somewhat on the value of cryptocurrencies at the time. Bitcoin's high and people are using GPUs. They might be harder to get. Right now, they're a little easier to get because Bitcoin's a bit below, at least what it was, you know, 8 months ago or 10 months ago. It's still pretty high, some might say. So we loaded nationwide stream reach points and 1 kilometer grid of inundation and depth of water table and a few other parameters. And we constructed SQL queries, SQL views to join the relatively stable geometries with hourly changing model outputs. And then we created some dashboards using the Immerse visualization client from MapD to visualize results. I think we'll have time to go over. So here's a chart that kind of puts into some context the different types of time that are represented in the model. One of the main ways to look at the model is how it predicts the present. So that's the diagonal flow here, evolution, looking at a diagonal, here's the valid time input date going in. The model runs, and hidden in there is the fact that the model takes a while to run, but since we're looking at this more in the past, and it takes about 90 minutes for present conditions to run, if you're expecting to operate on them within the hour, you'll be disappointed. But generally, it's useful for predicting present conditions in stream reaches where there are no gauges. There are only about 7,000 or 8,000 gauges on the 3 million stream reaches, so being able to predict flows where you don't have measurements is quite useful. So that's the diagonal. On the horizontal, we've got the prospective view. At a given valid time, we can ask, how are things doing with predicting the future? So 0 to 10 days, and that gives us a sense of how, at this time, things are being predicted. Certainly, we'd like to know if the storm or flood is being predicted 10 days in the future, how well the model's doing, and, of course, what we can do about it, what is the flood likely to impact, for example. And then a third, the vertical, the retrospective view. So this is really saying we have a certain day, and the first valid day, we're looking at 10 days into the future, but on the second, we're only looking 9 days in the future. On the third, 8 days in the future. So 10 days ahead, we're looking at present conditions. So generally, as most models do, they're much better at present conditions. So we can actually stand here in the future and say, how did the model do? And as we get closer to present conditions. And there's some surprising conditions where we know at day 10, there was pretty significant flooding. And at day 1, some of that might have been predicted. But in many cases, at that point, there's really nothing to see. Or it was predicted at a different location. And then finally, in day, say, 6 or 7, the prediction finally starts to say, you better watch out. There's going to be significant flooding in this location on this day, which is subsequently demonstrated by the actual predicting of the present and the actual present. So these are three paradigms for looking at models that are generating lots of predictions continually. Another way is to start looking at some of the functions of the model and saying, okay, is it it is predicting precipitation, it is predicting flow on the surface, and flow in streams. The physics say that those things happen with a certain time lag, and so we can look at both the actual versus predictive time lags and see how the model's doing in terms of those physics at the different time sites, at the different time slices. So there's lots of different ways that one can look at this data with differentiated time parameters to examine the accuracy of the model under various conditions, and also, of course, to help in actually applying the model, using it to help solve real-world problems. And here, I'm just going to give a quick demo of the... That's just a screenshot,
well, that's just a screenshot,
and that's the video.
Okay, sorry. This is the video.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't have access to it.
Okay, your sign is... Oh, I see. Right. Is there an easy way to solve that? I would have to show it from my machine, maybe.
Let's do this. When I go to the last little bit, you can go in and give me permission, and then we'll come back and show it at the end.
Sure. Sounds cool. Good. Yep.
Oops, you have to go back to the presentation. All
right, there you go. Okay. So this is what we're working on now. So the work I've presented was all done before MapD data store supported geospatial data types. We had X's and Y's, and we had to do significant work to both query and represent that in maps. Now MapD supports point-line polygeometries and has a couple of spatial operators, distance and point polygon, and more are being added continually. One of the interesting discussions right now is whether and in what way it might be useful to have grid cell or imagery data types in this database. It makes sense because a CPU is really intended to process polygons. That is one of the things GPUs do best. And if you look at images or coverages or global grids in terms of their polygon cells, it makes a lot of sense that could work well. But of course, the question is, what do you want to do with those cells? And does it make sense within this kind of data store? Right now, we're trying to use Kafka streams to interpret those .NET CDF files, as Aaron was describing. So we can have a rolling store in GPU memory of 1 or 2 months of data, which is continually refreshed because the model's always running. We also want to add in some of the forcing data. And then a lot of the applications will have to do with being able to impose those results on more interesting features. For example, it's nice to know that this spot on the Earth has flooding, but it's more useful if you happen to know there's a road there and that a meter of water on the road should probably generate some kind of activity to respond. So these situations provide opportunities for GPU-based or SQL-based applications that provide for interpretation, model feedback, decision support, when should you worry. One side task is to work with a data store that's been set up by David Arcdor of Hydrodata from Hurricane Harvey in the Houston area, which has both model runs for that area and a lot of observations data for that area. This will let us look at the model with respect to where it actually flooded, for example, which we hope will provide opportunities for making improvements to the model. So current activity, making use of and extending the current geospatial data types. So MapD can be even a more useful geospatial data platform, because that's the lens through which we're really looking at it as geospatial folks. We're also looking at other OGC standards, for example, coverage data types. Some initial work with LiDAR data sets is being done by some collaborators. This is initially just LiDAR data, a whole bunch of points, but having a coverage schema and maybe even some ways of indexing that is currently being looked at as a way to use MapD for working with imagery and other coverage-based data types. So we are attempting to extend what will work with the open source code. MapD is, of course, a commercial company, and they would love to provide the commercial product, which adds additional visualization capabilities, as well as more advanced clustering and others. But all the basic capabilities are in the core MapD core product and are available on GitHub. And I also want to provide a big shout out to Josh Lieberman, who works in our center at Harvard and is also a member, also works at OGC, is now a full-time OGC employee. And he was instrumental in this project. This project would not have happened without him, as well as Devika Kakkar of the Harvard CGA, who did the vast, the bulk of the programming that was involved and the scripting for this project. And with that, so just using model outputs, which are bona fide observations, may represent an even more complex variety of big data than a lot of typical observation data. But it is an important challenge to address, as there's an important, as there's a great opportunity here to improve the models. GPUs now provide a means to work with giant model outputs and to evaluate such models in ways that were not possible before. With climate change and other major natural forces in play, models such as the National Water Model and others are likely to become more important factors in our lives. A couple links. Here's our project wiki, which has all the details and scripts of that were developed by us for this project, and that's the MapD source code link. And now I'll pass it back to Aaron.
Fantastic. If you can just give me access to that file, we'll come back and look at that video, because it is worth seeing. So I just want to talk for a second about how we've now integrated Apache Kafka streaming into the front end of that whole process. So I think Ben was talking a little bit about how we did it manually to insert the data early on. Now we've improved that, and I'll just walk you through kind of what we did. As Ben was saying, the water model itself actually produces hourly results and puts those out into an FTP server. We mirror that then to a set of results files that we can manipulate using the Python scripts that Ben had talked about and a regular update. We take those files from NOAA and turn them into CSVs that we can import into MapD. We use a simple stream sets workflow for actually pulling new updates to those files, pushing them out onto Kafka. We believe that they'll be consumed by other applications long term, so that's why we've chosen to use Kafka for this particular application. Today, we're primarily consuming those then back into stream sets to be able to actually load into the MapD database.
once that happens, then you get the ability to do these visualizations using MapD. And this is all now automated from the standpoint of being able to see these regular hourly updates of data coming from the NOAA results FTP. So the data itself, and I think Ben had alluded to this, is available here. So you can go and take a look at the actual data that's provided by NOAA. This HPC on MOC repo is where you can find all kinds of information. The wiki that Ben talked about is great because it goes through in detail some of the lessons learned by Devika and the team as they were getting MapD up and running. But I'll also point you specifically to the Python scripts that were used in sort of the bottom part of that for doing the ETL on the data and getting it turned into something that MapD could ingest. So if you're interested in learning more about that, go take a look. And if you have questions about it, you can come talk to me. I'm also going to point you to another Kafka example we produced with a guy named Jawanza Joseph. Really smart guy, had streaming data from the bike sharing. So if you've seen these bike sharing around the world, it's Bixi here in Montreal, and it's, I forget what else, around the world. But there's hundreds of these bike sharing companies. They provide streams of their data, where bikes get picked up, where they get dropped off, how long the specific runs are, et cetera. So we created a pretty simple pipeline for being able to pull all that data into MapD using Kafka. He wrote a blog post about it. I encourage you to go take a look at it. It's another example of doing basically the same thing that we're doing for water model, but taking a more public data set, maybe a smaller data set that's a little bit more manageable if you want to try and get it up and running for yourself. With that, I'll just say, in terms of next steps, first and foremost, the demo that you saw for the ships demo and probably a dozen other public demos are available on our website. So if you want to go just play with MapD, get a sense of what the experience is like, and also see for yourself what the speed feels like. We've got a dozen different demos out there. My favorite one is probably the one with the NBA data. You can see a shot chart on the basketball court for where people, where the different players are taking shots, and it goes back like 10 years, so it's a really big set of data. We have a version of MapD that runs on our cloud. It's basically MapD as a service. If you go to mapd.cloud, you can get your own instance up and running in about 90 seconds. So if you have your own data and you want to upload it and you want to play with it and you want to see what it feels like and see what the performance looks like running on GPUs, that's probably the fastest way to do it. If you have your own GPUs and you want to run MapD there, no problem. We have a community edition that's available for download that you can run anywhere, either locally or in your favorite cloud, in your instance in the favorite cloud. So feel free to go and download there. And last but not least, we have a pretty active community on Discourse. So if you go to community.mapd.com, if you have any questions, you run into any problems, you need to dig deep on some technical aspect of how MapD works, please come join us because all of our engineers are actually actively involved in the community forum. With that, if I have access to the video, I'll go back and we should still have time for a few questions. There it is. Go. If you want to talk to it.
Yeah. So here's just a gives you a sense of the number of features in this data set. There's 2 million channel coordinates. There's 27 million channels. And now we're just going to take a look at a couple of the time. So this is present, and this is looking at difference between present and predicted and actual, and we're highlighting the difference. And this is really to give you a sense of sort of how rapidly MapD can render results to queries and get them to map. And the map on the left is interactive, so you could zoom in and out. This is all immerse, which is part of the For either research only, free for research only, or if it's not research, then it's then it's licensed. This is prospective flow, Again, looking at difference between predicted and actual, and yeah, that's really all I wanted to show. Yeah, do you want to end with?
Let me go back to the blog faces. So.
Great. I think we've got time for. Well, we're actually out of time, but maybe. Maybe I can take one question.
5 minutes.
5 minutes? Oh, okay, good. We got a little more time, I thought.
Question. The arrow extensions for other spatial data types, that sounds real interesting and valuable to others as well.
Yeah.
Can you say a little more about what you're doing there?
We're just starting it. So we just implemented the data types inside MapD core about 2-3 months ago, a little bit more than that maybe now. And so point line, poly, SC distance, SC contains was where we started. Now we're going to make that available through all of our interfaces and sort of going through them one by one. And so arrow will come, but we're not there yet. So don't have a timing for it yet because there's a few other product things that we're working on, but we are excited about it.
What the list that you just gave that was already in MapD?
It's in MapD core. Yeah, exactly.
MapD core.
Yeah. So those are native data types in the database that you can actually have an interesting demo. Maybe I'll just bring it up real quick. That shows so this is our demos page. If you go to the taxi rides, this is the one that probably shows the most interesting geospatial data set.
Where'd we get? From New York City.
Yeah, exactly. Shocking, right?
Yeah.
So
everybody loves this data.
So here's what we did, though. We actually took the 1.1 billion taxi rides. We joined it with 1 million footprints of buildings in New York City. So that's what you're seeing over here are actually the polygons for the buildings. We joined that data together. We said, show me where the taxi gets picked up, where the taxi started closest to which polygon. And then we colored them based on the tip percentage. So the blue ones are bad tippers. And the red ones are good tippers. So if I come down here, you can see which parts of New York City, if I were a taxi driver, I would want to troll around. Basically, here in Dumbo, I'd want to be over here. It's pretty
not
clear.
Manhattan.
Yeah, exactly.
Not
Wall
Street.
Not Manhattan.
Wall Street.
Williamsburg.
Yeah. And so if I zoom in down here, you'll see there's a few buildings that like get really hot, right? Like I'm gonna pick up as many people as I can from that one particular. I'm just gonna sit out front of that building, see how much money I can make.
Maybe it was one guy who tipped $100 or something.
Yeah. But this is an interesting way to think about how we're now starting to look at these new joins with spatial data types. So it's not just about – big data for us isn't just about having all your data in one gigantic table. It's actually about how do you combine these data sets together that actually starts to create interesting big data problems. One more quick thing on this data set just because I think it's kind of cool. If you notice, there's a dip in December for these tips, which means people are tipping significantly less, like noticeably less in December. Now, you might think, the Grinch in you might think, that's because these people are being really stingy, right? Like, here's the time for giving, and everybody's like not giving to their cab driver. The reality is, it's because of all of these. Zero tips. Like, there's a lot. Almost half the data is a zero tip. That's because when you pay with cash, they don't record the tip. They just put the tip in their pocket, and they say, oh, guy didn't give me a tip. So it turns out at Christmas time, people pay more in cash, and that's what causes that dip to go down, right? So by playing with this data a little bit, by being able to zoom in on specific parts of it, get rid of the cash data, for instance, get rid of those zero tips so we can take that out of the data, it's really easy to find sort of why that anomaly happens at Christmas time each year. And then we can go in even further and see how at Christmas time there aren't as many taxi rides in Manhattan, which is also part of that, dearth of tips in Manhattan. But it turns out that the tippers are actually coming from other parts of the city during that time of year. So anyway, I just like that because it helps us paint the bigger picture of why you'd want to combine data sets like this to tell a bigger story. With that, I think we are out of time.
Let me make one other comment, though, and that is, you know, we saw a lot about the database and the GPU, and that's amazing what you guys are doing. People may not realize, though, what was also presented about the spatial temporal aspects and the semantics that the chart there, that was the first time I'd seen that stair-step chart, trying to get after the semantics of current time, phenomenon time, predictive time, all those things. That is at the forefront of spatial-temporal understanding right now in databases, so that shouldn't be go past even.
No, it's a critical point. And you know, I think Ben's been on the forefront of that with this particular water model data set. And the more we start to see prediction and AI and ML become a standard part of what people expect out of a database, that's going to become a standard part of how we present the data. It'll be there for every data set, not just for the data sets like this that are automatically predictive. But I don't know, Ben, if you have anything more to add to that.
No, just that... you know, MapD, I think, especially for this group and probably for, like, phosphor G-type groups, you know, thinking about this in a tool chain is really kind of the way to think about MapD. It's kind of like a Ferrari, you know? Like, you want it at certain critical times, and at certain times, like, when you need to get away from somebody really fast and scary. You want that Ferrari, and other times, you know, you might be needing to take a while to do some more certain kinds of processing or analytics using PostGIS scaled up or some kind of Spark processes, maybe GeoMesa for certain kinds of things. But when you need to interactively explore or, in some cases, analyze your data, and it's billions of things, you know, that's kind of the only, I think it's the only game in town.
I think that's the title of my next talk. The zombie apocalypse is coming, and we're the Ferrari to get you out of town. All right, very good. As I said, I'll stick around if anybody has any questions.